Our first sponsor for today's podcast is Dying Breed Music. If you don't know about these guys yet, Lane over at Dying Breed keeps stocking ridiculously great acoustic guitars from the golden era. He's quickly become one of the go-to shops for vintage guitar collectors. If you are not following him yet, you really should. He's currently offering a 1941 Gibson Super Jumbo 100. How often do you see those? He also has a 1917 Martin 0045, one of only three made that year. That still has the original case, and it's ivory bridge, so you probably don't want to go on your big overseas tour with that. But if those are too exotic, he has a 1949 Martin D28 and a lot more. I don't know how he gets all this stuff, but I do know he does a ton of consignments. So if you have any instruments in your closet you want to part ways with, reach out to Lane at dyingbreedguitars.com. He's open 6 days a week, and he's always super responsive if you have any questions about his inventory. And please tell him the Fretboard Journal sent you. All right, welcome to the Fretboard Journal's 151st podcast. Thank you all for all the great feedback we received over our 150th episode, where yours truly was grilled by luthier Megan Wells. I had a blast talking to Megan. We got some great comments. We even got a few story ideas from some of our listeners. And yes, I fielded some questions about the musical saw too. So thank you all for reaching out and tuning in. As always, if you want to get all of the Fretboard Journal podcast, there's an easy way to do it. Just subscribe to us via iTunes or Stitcher or however you download and listen to podcasts. And if you have an episode in particular that you like, by all means, we hope you'll share it with your friends on Facebook and Twitter. Our other sponsor today is Retrofret Vintage Guitars. I don't think they have any of my beloved musical saws right now, but they do have an original Leon Theremin-built theremin, which, frankly, will get you all those sounds and is a heck of a lot more collectible. They can probably find you pretty much any rare or unique fretted instrument you're looking for. They got a 1934 Gibson F7 mandolin in recently. Those were only made for a couple years. That thing is beautiful. They also got a 65 Gibson Firebird 3 and a Martin 018 from 1950. As you hopefully know, beyond carrying all those great vintage banjos, guitars, and mandolins, they also do top-notch repairs and restorations. So go to retrofret.com and tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. And by all means, follow them on Instagram, and you'll learn about their new arrivals long before I get around to telling you about them on the Fretboard Journal podcast. Okay, so today we have a fun episode in store for you. If you've read the Fretboard Journal for a while or you've listened to this podcast, you know that I love uncovering some of the lesser known histories of the world of guitars, both acoustic and electric. And today I'm talking to luthier Mark Whitebook. His name comes up if you've read guitar books or guitar magazines over the years. He built instruments for James Taylor, Carly Simon, Phil Keaggy, even Clarence White. He was building them in the 70s when mass-produced guitars were kind of at their low point. He was sort of at the forefront of, I guess, what we would call the modern luthery movement, along with a couple of other guys like David Russell Young and Noble and Gurian and Mossman and Bozo and Gallagher. I guess that's more than a couple guys. He was at the top of his game. He was building these exquisite guitars. And then around 1980, after building around 70 guitars total, mostly dreadnoughts, he basically hung it up. He got a day job and moved away from the world of guitar making. If you look on the internet, internet lore will tell you that it was all about the dust affecting his health. Obviously, making guitars creates a lot of dust and wood particles flying through the air and all that good stuff. As he tells us, there was a lot more to the story than just that. So it's a very interesting tale. I hope you like it. Mark put all of his tools in storage, and then a couple of years ago pulled the tarps off of them and decided to start building guitars again for his friends and family. And I met him at the Fretboard Journal, at the Fretboard Summit in San Diego last year. We talked. It was great to put a face to the name. He reached out about a month ago and told me there was a typo in the Fretboard Journal 38. A guitar that we actually attributed to him that is owned by Leo Kaki actually came from David Russell Young. We got to talking again. I said, hey, do you want to do an interview for the magazine and maybe the podcast? And that is what you are about to hear. I hope you enjoy it. As always, keep the feedback coming. If you have any suggestions of artists you want us to cover or people you want us to interview for the podcast, just let us know. Jason@fretboardjournal.com is the easiest way to get a hold of me. And last but not least, if you love learning about this stuff, if you love finding content and listening to content that you can't find anywhere else via the Fretboard Journal, please subscribe to our magazine. Our 39th issue is mailing out next week. It's a perfect time to subscribe. You can use the coupon code PODCAST and save $5. Issue 39 has features on Ken Parker, Chris Eldridge, and Julian Lage, the amazing electric guitars of Harvester Guitars down in Australia, and so much more. You can go to fretboardjournal.com and sign up for that, or you can just call us here, 877-373-8273, and we would be happy to take care of you. Without further ado, here is my talk with Mark Whitebook. I hope you enjoy it. I had a blast talking to him, and thanks for listening. So Mark, where did you, I know you've been in Southern California pretty much your whole life, but where did you actually grow up?
San Fernando Valley.
And were you exposed to music at a pretty early age?
No one in my family played. So I guess the only exposure that I would have had was, you know, what was around on the radio.
Yeah.
Started listening to rock and roll when I was probably 8 or 9, got a transistor radio when I was 10. That was a big deal.
I bet. And then
that would have been.
Oh no! When did the guitar come into play?
I started playing in high school. I was 16, almost 17, and I started playing steel string guitar. A friend of mine was a banjo player. He'd bring his banjo to school. I'd bring my guitar to school. One of our high school teachers was a guitar player, you know, folk guitarist. And we'd hang out in his classroom when it wasn't being used for, you know, for teaching and play. So I started out playing behind a banjo player. So I was playing a lot of bluegrass. This is one of my, you know, good friends, and that sort of led into having a couple of groups, a jug band at first, and then a bluegrass band. So I did a lot of flat picking back then in high school.
And you were playing a Martin?
I bought a D28, and so I had that until after high school, maybe the first year or two, and then I started working at a music store. And the guy that owned the music store was a flamenco player, really a good player, and, you know, an accompanist, so he was a serious player. And at the same time, a couple of very good friends of mine who were guys that were in the band had gone to Spain for probably a year or more to a ranch run by a guy named Don Corn. And Don Corn had, I've never been there, so I don't know what the details were, but I think it was kind of a live-in flamenco school.
Okay.
And it seemed to have a lot of Americans there. I don't know if Porin is an American. It didn't look like a Spanish name to me. But they had gone to Spain, come back as flamenco players. Then I was working in the music shop for another flamenco player, which led to my getting interested in flamenco. So I sold the Martin and bought a flamenco guitar from one of these friends that had been to Spain and brought it back with them.
Got it. And what was the name of the store you worked at?
It was Casa Andaluz.
All right.
And it was in Reseda. It was right near what is now Cal State Northridge and was then Valley State College, which is where I was theoretically going to school, but between music and the other things that young men do, I was enrolled but not attending. So that kind of ended my early college career, ended in favor of music.
Got it. And did this store, was it appealing? Was it, describe the store a little bit beyond the flamenco, or was it mostly flamenco stuff?
Well, it was an everything store because there's no real business in flamenco, at least there wasn't back then.
Okay.
You know, he worked as an accompanist and he was a great guy, and other flamencos hung out there, but it was your basic steel string guitars, nylon string guitars, electric guitars on the wall. It was a small storefront. I want to say it was on Reseda Boulevard, but I don't recall exactly, but it was right by Cal State Northridge. They had some small studio spaces for lessons. I did a little bit of teaching there, but I was you're not a good teacher.
Not a good student, not a good teacher.
Yeah, there were a lot of things that I didn't do well back then, and those were two of them.
Okay. So I'm curious, you know, you said you played in bluegrass setting and a jug band, now flamenco. Were you kind of becoming a discerning guitarist when it came to guitars? Were you thinking about construction much at this age?
Actually, about the time that I got the flamenco was a Manuel Contreras. And Contreras was a good Spanish builder, very good Spanish builder. And the flamenco guitars were my first exposure. They weren't my first. They were my first hands-on exposure to handmade musical instruments. When I was a flat picker, I used to go to a folk club in Hollywood called the Ash Grove.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of bluegrass acts there. And there were other acts. There were, you know, it was blues and folk. And it was whatever would sell drinks. And there was a little music store in the front of the Ash Grove called Eagle Music. And I don't know who ran it. It seemed to be like a rotating cast of characters. But they had a Roy Noble guitar up hanging, you know, in the expensive guitar section of this little kiosk that was the music store. And so I knew of Roy Noble guitars. I knew they were handmade. I knew they were good. I knew that Roy Noble was also in the San Fernando Valley, as was my friend David Russell Young. So Dave Young was in the Valley. And Chuck Erickson, the Duke of Pearl,
sure,
and had Erica Banjos, all in the San Fernando Valley. So it was kind of this little knot of builders and people associated with it. So I knew of Roy Noble, but I'd never played any of Roy's guitars. So this Contreras was the first time I really had the chance to sit and play a long time on a handmade instrument, which was really kind of a revelation for me because, you know, a nicely made flamenco, or a classic for that matter, is a really responsive instrument. You know, you get a lot out of relatively, you know, low mass, low tension strings. And so it was really interesting for me to make that change. And at the same time, part of my triumvirate for flunking out of Valley State College was I got a copy of Irving Sloan's book, Classic Guitar Construction.
Of course.
You know the book?
It's referenced all the time in both the podcast and in our magazine.
Yeah, so I think the book was first published in 66, and I would have probably gotten my hands on it in 67 or 68. And so I just read the book, you know, to death. I just memorized it. So now I had a good flamenco guitar. I was playing flamenco. I was hanging out with people that had handmade Spanish instruments, and in particular, the guy who was the owner of this Casa Andaluz music store. He had a Marcelo Barbero flamenco. He had an Arcángel Fernández flamenco. And while I was there, he bought a Maple 1925. I know who it was. It was a brilliant builder. Well, it will come back to me.
Sure.
So he had a little collection of really good flamenco guitars. And so I was around a lot of good guitars.
Yeah.
And then I had this book, and then I had not much, but some background in woodworking. And, you know, just as a high school kid and also just as a hobbyist. So I kind of synthesized those interests. The builder was Santos Fernandez.
Oh, of course.
Not somebody whose name I should forget.
Sure.
But this Santos was really just a tremendous instrument, really a cannon. So with all these good guitars around me and playing, you know, trying to play like serious musicians, and Irving Sloan's book, which was, you know, just really groundbreaking, I bought the wood and decided to build a guitar. So my first couple of guitars were both flamenco guitars because that's what I was playing, that's what I owned, and that was what classic guitar construction Georgia had to build.
And were you, you mentioned that you were friends with Chuck Erickson and David Russell Young. Were you, so you knew that there were guys out there beyond Noble building guitars out of their garage, I take it.
Yes. Well, Chuck Erickson, Chuck was in the big time. Chuck had a shop in Van Nuys by the Chevy plant. So he had Erica banjos. He wasn't, he had just acquired the pearl cutting stuff, the machinery, from the guy that was his previous shell supplier, shell blank supplier, who had decided to get out of the business. And Chuck acquired all his grinding tools and probably some bags of shell to get started with. And the reason I knew Chuck is by this time I was roommates. This was after high school. I was roommates, flaking out of college, with my best friend banjo player. And the banjo player, because he was a banjo player in the Valley, everybody hung out at Chuck's shop, and he eventually had Chuck build him a banjo. So I knew Chuck through the bluegrass angle and the banjo construction angle, and I actually spent time working for Chuck cutting shell
before in
his shop at Van Nuys.
Before you started building on your own.
Actually, I started working for Chuck after I had completed my first guitar.
Okay. So there's kind of a perfect storm brewing of all this stuff guiding you to the world of guitar making. What was Chuck's shop like? I mean, I can only picture in my head what his Erica Banjo's headquarters were like, but can you describe them?
Dusty.
Okay.
Once he had the shell cutting tools, the place was covered in a permanent fine coating of calcium carbonate dust. Mm-hmm. It was just everywhere. Which means it wasn't a very good place for me to visit, much less to work in, because I have really bad lungs. I mean, I've had asthma since infancy.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you're young, you just sort of imagine you're going to power through all these things somehow by force of will, but that doesn't work very well. It works for a while. But so Chuck's shop was dusty.
Yeah.
It was busy. One of the things that I learned that I should have learned from Chuck's shop and didn't, and had to learn it on my own, was that Chuck's shop was just this crossroads of people. I mean, individuals and bands, you know. You get a bass and a guitar and a banjo show up at Chuck's shop, you know, with their players, and they would sit and play thinking that he was running a salon, you know. And so it was always crowded with people, and it was always players, and Chuck was, I think, too nice to tell people, get out of my shop, you're keeping me from doing my work. So it was like that. There was lots of music. There was lots of dust. Chuck's work, of course, was, you know, the work that he was able to do when we weren't keeping him from doing it was just extraordinary. I mean, Chuck was the first guy I saw who was obviously, clearly doing art, just pure straight art, with his banjo construction, and particularly with his pearl and his inlay. You know, he's just one of those graphic arts, right brain guys to whom I don't know that it comes easily because I'm not Chuck, but I know that it comes, and he does really just unbelievably breathtaking stuff.
Yeah.
Really beautiful in life.
So you're...
And he's an interesting guy.
He's one of the best.
If you spend my time talking with him, he's probably the most interesting person I know, and I'm, 68.
Yeah.
So
going back to that first guitar, where did you get parts for it? What was your intention? What did you, I think you said it was a nylon string.
It was a flamenco guitar. Yeah. So it was a Spanish cypress back and sides, spruce top, mahogany neck, ebony fingerboard, and most of that came from Vitali Imports, which was in, I want to say, Maywood, suburb of Los Angeles. Vitaly Imports was really a violin luthier store, but they had a little bit of guitar stuff. You could get tuning machines. We got Schallers there. They had stacks of, fingerboards and tops, and backs and sides. I don't recall if they had much of anything in Rosewood. I think they had, I know they had the Cypress because I bought that there.
And
So that was where I bought the wood for my first and my second instruments, which were both flamenco and both Cypress back and sides with spruce tops.
And did you have to go out and accumulate a bunch of tools? And were you thinking this was going to be kind of a cottage industry for yourself?
I was really just thinking about building the guitars. I wasn't thinking about a career. That's, if you could see me, there are air quotes around that. I didn't need much in the way of tools for either of these because Sloan's book includes steps of hand scraping backs and sides and tops down to thickness from, from their cut and joined thickness. So I did that all work. I did all that work with a hand scraper.
Okay.
Which is really hard work. I mean, it's just hard physical work and takes a long time, but it's a real good education in how the wood works and feels and responds. So, I wouldn't want to do it again today, but it was a good thing to do back then. So I had chisels.
Okay.
Hams. I had just basic stuff.
Hide glue? No hide glue?
Nope. I used tight bond right from the start.
Okay. And how did that first guitar turn out?
Terrible. Well, bad enough that I was embarrassed by it later. Later on, when Dave Yagan and I were sharing a shop in Topanga, one night we had a party and broke it into pieces and
yep.
And destroyed it. It was a rite of passage. It was not a very smart thing to do, but it seemed like, at the time it was more of an embarrassment than it was an asset. With the benefit of hindsight, I can see that it would be nice to still have that as a reminder of where we all start.
Sure.
But
were you able to look at your, or play your Contreras and then play your first guitar and know where you screwed up or where it didn't work out?
Actually, it played fine.
Yeah.
Because I knew how to set up guitars. I had already done that. I didn't make any one, horrendous blunder. And it didn't sound bad. It wasn't symmetrical because I had decided to try one. If I'm remembering correctly, one of the things that Sloan says in his book is that there are some Spanish builders who do not use molds, that they bend the sides, dead net exactly to shape. And I thought, well, if the good guys can do that, I'll try doing that.
Sure.
And so, it was a little bit asymmetrical, at least enough that it bothered me. It had, because I was playing a guitar that had friction pegs, it was real flamenco style, but I was used to using pegs. Those worked fine, actually, because I had a friend who was making pegs, and I had a reamer that was exactly the right taper for the pegs. So, those all worked. So it wasn't that it was coming apart or didn't play or, it was unplayable. It was not to the standards of my second guitar, simply because the learning curve on anything that's new is so steep,
Yeah.
So, you make all your gains, you make these huge gains between number one and number two. And I was a little embarrassed by number one. So.
And was number two your attempt to just kind of correct those wrongs, or were you thinking you'd sell number two, or what was the thought?
The idea with number two was to make another guitar, just pure and simple. I just got it in my system that I had to build another one at least. And The second guitar came out fine. And what happened to the second guitar was I took it to Fred Wallachy at Westwood Music. Mm-hmm. And Fred agreed to buy it. So now, you know, now I was a guitar maker.
Yeah.
My second guitar is all. And really what I was interested in was getting, you know, if I could sell the guitar, I could get money for maybe a couple of more sets of wood, which was the objective of that.
Yeah.
And by that time, and I don't remember the mechanics of all this, but I knew David Russell Young because David had, I don't recall if David had any guitars for sale at Casa Andaluz where he worked, but he would come in there. He was friends with Ben Shearer, the fellow that owned the store. And so he was in there a lot, and I got to know Dave. And he was working out of his parents' garage, and I was working out of my parents' garage. You know, and we were both living at home, and neither of us had much money, and neither of us had big power tools. We didn't have a big bandsaw, so we could do resawing on our own. So I proposed to Dave that we pool our resources and rent a shop together. And so we rented our first shop in Topanga Canyon. So that was the first real shop, and that happened about sometime after I sold that second guitar. So I had the money from that and the wood that I had purchased with the money. I don't recall how we financed all of this. David was selling guitars. David was pretty established by then. He was building mostly classics at that point.
Yeah. So this would be what, 1968, 69?
I want to say that this was 1969. So it was either late 69 or early 70. And we rented space in Topanga Canyon, Camp Wildwood. Camp Wildwood was where the original Topanga Canyon Banjo and Fiddle Contest was held.
Yeah.
So I knew that area because we used to go and compete in the Banjo and Fiddle Contest. So, you know, I knew it reasonably well. And there was a little shop space that was for lease. So we moved in there. I don't recall how big it was. I would guess it was maybe 700 square feet, maybe a little less.
And were you living out of it too?
Very briefly, until the landlord told me that I couldn't live out of it, which, you know, it wasn't zoned for living in.
So
I kind of started out.
Yeah, I mean, this has to be like a crazy shift from basically building guitars out of your parents' garage in the suburbs to Topanga Canyon in 1969 or 70.
Well, yeah, I mean, Topanga Canyon in 1969 and 70, and 71 and 72, which was when I was there with sharing the shop with David. That was a great place to be, you know. It was the center of, well, I don't know if it was the center. It was certainly a nexus of hippie life.
Yeah.
You know, so it was pretty good.
So you set up the shop with David in Topanga Canyon, and you're already, sounds like you've sold a guitar to Westwood Music, which is sort of one of the big, it's almost like you were saying earlier about Chuck's shop, like in its heyday, it was both an incredible guitar store, but also a hangout for all the local musicians. Are you hanging out with some of LA's finest rock and roll guys and folk guys at this point?
No, when you're making guitars, you know, I kind of had my head down. I was hanging out with Dave. We were in the shop all the time. We didn't have any money.
Yeah.
I didn't have a car. I had a motorcycle. I didn't have a car till I was 22.
Okay.
So, you know, we had no money. Westwood Music, you know, being a big music store, Westwood Music is rightfully a place where you want musicians hanging out because they're going to do business there. That's appropriate. A guitar making shop is not a very good place to have people hanging out. And, you know, we didn't have much problem with that in Topanga. I had a little more problem with that in my second shop, but I'll kind of come to that.
Okay.
So no, I wasn't really hanging out. My life consisted of working in the shop, you know, trying to get enough money together for food. It was, you know, a lot of Kraft macaroni and cheese made on a hot plate.
Yeah.
And then when the guitar was done, Fred Wallachy at Western Music had agreed to take everything I could build, which is not very much. You don't have huge output. So that's a one-man shop. So I was building guitars, and when the guitar was done, I would get it to Fred. You know, Fred would write me a check, and then I'd have enough money to pay the rent and kind of stay in wood and supplies and craft macaroni and cheese.
And do you know what Fred was selling these for?
Originally, I think they were selling for about $750.
Okay.
And the dealer discount was 50%.
Okay.
So that would have meant I was getting about $375, and Fred was selling them for about $750. And later on, they might have gone up to about $1,000. And Fred also, unilaterally, without being prompted, he volunteered to cut his dealer discount from 50% to 40% because he knew that, you know, Dave Young and I were not living the high life. So that helped a little bit.
Yeah.
And the prices went up a little bit. But to put it in perspective, back then shop rent was about $150 a month. And Kraft dinners were 25 cents. So it wasn't a lot of money, but it was barely self-sustaining if you didn't have other expenses.
Yeah. And I know you were just barely scraping by, but that was, in that day and era, probably pretty good money for a guitar. Right?
You know, it was about D28 money.
Yeah.
If you were building a Rosewood Dreadnought, you know, which in retrospect, I now call those days the tyranny of the Rosewood Dreadnought. We're all building Rosewood Dreadnoughts because we all imagined that we were competing with Martin and the D28. You know, the difference is that I'm told in the 70s, you know, somewhere I read that Martin Guitar Factory was building about 70 guitars a day.
Yeah.
And the builders like me were building 10 or 12 a year if you really busted your ass. And, you know, I only built about 70 guitars from the time I started to the time I closed up my shop in 1980. So It was a difference in understanding. You know, there really was not a premium market for handmade musical instruments. And the only reason I think that Fred Wallachy had a personal ability to understand what a handmade musical instrument was when his father was a violin maker. So Westwood Music originally, when his father was alive, was, you know, a very high-end violin, a kind of a philharmonic musical instrument shop where you bought stuff from the violin family, you know, for good money.
Yeah.
Fred's dad died when he was very young. I think Fred was only 19 or 20 when his dad died. So he took over the store. So here's this young guy who's maybe just a year or two older than me, and he takes over this store. But, you know, Fred took over the store kind of during the heyday of rock and roll, but Fred already had an intuitive understanding of handmade musical instruments, you know, and expensive musical instruments. So he was very sympathetic to guys like Dave Young and myself, and I don't think you could have found that at most music stores.
Yeah. And, you know, and
it was a unique time.
Yeah. And at what point, I'm assuming it happened in the Topanga Canyon space, did you decide to start building steel string guitars?
Actually, after the first two guitars, everything I built after that was steel strings. So I started, because I knew steel strings because I had been a bluegrass player. So I started building Rosewood Dreadnoughts. And at the time, it's another name that's going to escape me, but it was, oh, Fred Gerlach.
Mm-hmm.
Fred Gerlach was a builder, and Fred also had a business resawing wood. So he had a Delta 14-inch bandsaw with a neck block extension that let you resaw to 12 inches. And in fact, when Dave Young and I started the shop in Topanga, we each went out and got some bigger tools and kind of pooled all our tools. So we had one equipped shop that was that where different bits were owned by either myself or David. David bought Fred Gerlach's old bandsaw, so that showed up in our shop. I don't know what Fred replaced it with, but we had Gerlach's old 14-inch bandsaw, so we could resaw on that. And then I brought a jointer and a 6x48-inch belt sander that I had acquired just for the shop. And then the small hand tools were all, you know, individually owned. You don't share chisels and stuff. That's personal. It's like jewelry. Where was I going with
this? Steel
screen. Oh, Fred Gerlach. Yeah. Fred Gerlach had a business resawing wood. So I was buying rosewood from Fred, because everything from that point on was almost all Brazilian rosewood or East Indian rosewood. And Brazilian either had just been embargoed or it had been embargoed previously, and there was still some just in the pipeline that people had and were resawing. Because it was around for a few years after the original Brazilian embargo.
Mm-hmm.
So I acquired some Brazilians, a couple sets of which I have to this day. And I was buying sets from Fred, and later on I started buying boards and resawing everything myself. And I don't recall when that was. I don't know if I did much resawing when I was sharing a shop with David, or if I started doing all the serious resawing when I moved into my first solo shop and bought a big bandsaw.
And were you building steel, or did you decide to start building steel string dreadnoughts just because you wanted to, or were you feeling like they might sell a little easier at Fred's shop? Or
I think that was probably the only thing that was really going to sell at Fred's shop. It was the steel string world. I mean, when you're building classics in flamencos, you're competing with all the great builders of Spain, all of whom have reputations, and many of whom even then were already on second generation builders.
Yeah.
You know, by then, Los Sobrinos de Esteso, which were the nephews of Domingo Esteso, now that was a second generation group that was building guitars after Domingo Esteso had, I don't know if Esteso had retired or had passed by then, but you know, Spain was already on multiple generations of history, and we're just a bunch of kids, so there wasn't much of a market for classical instruments. I think you really kind of struggled. You just couldn't get really decent money for them.
Yeah.
David Young was building really great classics, and so he had made a market as a classical builder, but Dave also transitioned to building steel strings because that's what Fred could sell, because it was all part of the whole folk boom thing.
Yeah.
So eventually that was all I was building at that point, was steel strings.
And did you do any repair work at all?
No. I kind of decided early on to focus on building and not repairing, because my sense was, and it turned out to be, I think, pretty accurate, is that if you're trying to build and you start doing repairs and you're any good at the repairs, pretty soon you become a full-time repair shop.
Sure.
You know, and the lure of it is the money is better doing repairs. You know, so if you thought that you would try and supplement the guitar making thing by doing repairs and make a little more money and, you know, help subsidize the guitar making, I was pretty sure that soon if you did a good job, you'd end up being a repairman and you wouldn't be a builder anymore.
Yeah.
And I just wasn't interested in doing that. It's nice to have the, you know, it's nice to be able to fix guitars. But I also believe that the guys that repair guitars full time are better at repairing things than builders are at repairing things.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm just curious, the world of steel strings, at least now, everybody talks about forward shifted bracing and how Martin evolved, their pre-war guitars evolved and popsicle braces and all this minutia. But back in the 1970, I'm guessing that knowledge was kind of just hands-on or word of mouth. You certainly couldn't look it up on the internet or in any books. Were you striving for a certain model of dreadnought or a style of, you know, sound that you heard, or what?
Well, the only thing I took from Martin, well, not the only thing, there are certainly two things I took from Martin, was the shape of my dreads was copied onto a piece of paper by tracing around a, you know, one of the Martin D's with a pencil.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
So, because that's the dreadnought shape. And my classical mold was likewise traced around the body of a Marcello Barbero Flamenco by my friend and mentor Ben Shearer, because his Barbero was just my absolute favorite guitar in the world. It was just this fabulous player's instrument, and I love the look of it. So, you know, I traced around those. So what I took from Martin was I traced the dreadnought size, and, you know, for that I owe them. And Martin, I knew that Martin had evolved the X bracing. You know, and the X bracing made perfect structural strength to me, but a structural sense to me. You know, structurally, it's a real good way to keep the top from coming right off the guitar when you've got, you know, 175 pounds of tension on it. But what I didn't do was I had not at that point. I understood the mythology of the pre-war Martin because I had friends that had owned pre-war Martins, you know, HD28s, mm-hmm. and, you know, interesting old stuff. But I didn't start from the standpoint that my objective was to build a replica of a pre-war Martin guitar, or that that's how good they could be, or even that that's how the construction of the bracing had to be. I really started... My starting point was coming out of building classicals.
Yeah.
And understanding that the body shapes were different. The bracing, the top bracing certainly had to be far more robust because the tensions involved were far more robust. But the way I evolved my bracing really has more to do with the summer that I spent working for Roy Noble.
Which we didn't even talk about. You got to tell me how that happened.
Well, the way that happened was when I was cutting shell for Chuck Erickson. Roy and Chuck were good friends, and I think still are. And Roy was in the shop, and I think Roy asked Chuck if it seemed like I could do stuff with my hands, you know, without screwing it up.
Sure.
And Chuck must have answered in the affirmative. So Roy asked if I would come and you know, work in his shop for a while. So I stayed there through, it must have been most of a summer, you know, probably two or three guitars came out during that time, you know, and
this was,
and Roy.
Roy was Roy, by himself?
I was working for Roy. I think Roy had a whole succession of people that worked for him. There was another young guy there off and on whose name I don't recall. But Roy was a really interesting and smart guy, and so much of my approach to building I owe completely to Roy, because Roy was really brilliant with tools and really fearless with tools. You know, he would build stuff, he would modify stuff, he would do things that you know, people tell you you can't do, and he would make it work. Really creative and imaginative. But Roy, in the course of this time with Roy, I don't remember what the context of the discussion was, but he made the comment that the most important brace on the guitar is the bridge. It's just an offhand thing.
Sure.
And, you know, that was a real eye-opener for me, because I always thought of the bridge is the bridge where the strings attach, you know, that's the anchor and it carries a saddle. And then I always thought of all the bracing as being the stuff that's on the underside of the top that you don't see. And it's like a light bulb went on when Roy said that. I realized that's, you know, that's obviously ridiculous. The top, everything that's glued to the top is structural. Because of the forces involved, it better be structural. And the bridge is the most important brace on the top. You know, just because it's on the visible side of the top doesn't make it not a brace. And just because it's called a bridge doesn't make it not a brace. And so, kind of armed with that insight from Roy as a starting place, what I did was take a big piece of paper, you know, draw the outline of the guitar on it, put the bridge where it has to go. If you specify that it's a, if you know the scale length and you know that it's a 14 fret neck, then you know exactly where the saddle is going to go, you know, adding in a little bit for compensation for fretting tension. And then you draw on the saddle, then you draw the bridge, and now you've got the bare starting point. You know, you've got what it looks like with just that one thing. And then I started adding in the two main structural braces, the X braces, the cross brace that is under the top at the end of the fingerboard, and then all the additional braces that are there. And so I laid those all out, but starting with the bridge as if I were seeing through a transparent top. Hmm. And that's still how I do it to this day. Whenever I decide to fool around with a different body outline, you know, that's the starting point. You lay down the saddle, draw on the bridge, and then start drawing the braces underneath it and build that. So the whole idea of forward shifting and backward shifting and stuff, I can honestly say, the first time I heard the expression forward shifted braces, my first thought was, which way is forward? You know, is it toward the peg head, or is it toward, you know, toward the bottom block?
Yeah.
So that stuff is kind of foreign to me.
Yeah.
And it's probably because I didn't come from the perspective of starting by trying to minutely replicate a pre-war Martin. I didn't think that was particularly relevant.
Yeah.
I thought I would probably have to build stuff and figure it out as I went. Which, of course, that's how it played out.
Yeah. Were you doing much in terms of, you know, what is now considered voicing? Were you shaving the braces, scalloping the braces, doing anything like that?
I do not use scallop braces. And I have never used scalp braces. I don't go into guitars after I have built them with cutting tools.
Yeah.
And start removing wood from the underneath, because I don't. I certainly would not make a judgment in anybody else who claims to have skills at doing that. But I know that it would scare me shitless. Start playing with edge tools on the inside of the guitar, you know, thinking that I'm going to be doing precision, knowledgeable work.
Yeah.
Having never done it, I'm sure I would make a mess of it. So, you know, my perspective is, if there's something about a guitar that I don't like or that I think I can do better at, I try and correct it when I build the next one, or change it when I build the next one.
Yeah.
Correct is probably the wrong word. You know, you try and figure out what change you want. First, you try and figure out why you got what you got. You know, then what you might want to change, and then you make the change and see how that comes out. All the time understanding that there's no such thing as a controlled experiment in guitars. because, you know, even if the woods are from successive cuts, even if the tops are from successive cuts from the same board, and the same for the backs and the sides and the neck, you know, every guitar is a little bit different irrespective of the woods. And in general, you know, by the time you say, well, it's a top from a different board, you know, now it's sort of a game reset. So it's very difficult to do what you would consider good controlled experimentation.
Yeah.
Unless you're willing to steam a guitar apart, you know, shave off the braces, put new bracing on, and put that same top back on the same back and sides. And then you have the problem of accurate evaluation of the change, of how does it sound now versus how did it sound a month ago when I had it with different parts.
Totally. I have to think two of the big differences from going from the flamenco world to the steel string dreadnought world would be the neck joint and perhaps the finish. How did you tackle each of those things, and did that evolve as you started building steel strings?
All this credit goes to Roy Noble. Roy had pioneered the epoxy glued fitted butt joint.
Okay.
At the heels. My first two flamencos were built straight out of the book from Irving Sloan. So those had an integral neck, meaning the heel and the top block were all part of the neck, and that you slotted into that assembly at the heel, and then you put the sides into the slots. So it was all integral. Once it was built, there was no taking apart, no dovetail. Roy had pioneered necks where the heel was butt joined using epoxy to the body. And there were Noble guitars out there that were several years old, you know, that I knew had held up just fine. So I decided I was going to go with that. And in fact, I have a 1971, March of 1971, Mark Whitebook steel string dreadnought. So it's a very early guitar of mine. And, you know, it's got the butt glued neck, and it was on the road for probably 14 or 15 years. And it belonged to Phil Keggy.
Yeah.
I bought this back from Phil Keggy in the mid-80s at an auction when he needed money at a local music store. And so I've got a 46-year-old Mark Whitebook steel string dreadnought, you know, with an epoxy butt-glued neck. So I know they'll go about 50 years at least. If they'll go 50 years, I figure they'll go, you know, 100 years if something else doesn't take the guitar out, so...
Definitely. How long did you and David share the shop space?
I want to say probably more than two, but less than 3 years. I didn't answer your question about finish.
Though. Oh, yeah, go for it.
Nitrocellulose lacquer. That's what I started using. I do not a French polish, but I wouldn't French polish a steel string. I might French polish the top of a classic if I built another one today. In fact, I probably would, because it's such a nice, elegant finish.
Yeah.
But it doesn't hold up very well to, you know, to hard use. Nitrocellulose lacquer. So that's what we had. That's what we sprayed. It was obtainable. It was really a very good finish if you learn how to use it. And in fact, one of the biggest challenges, one of the things that I set aside a couple of months for when I did this re-entry into building in late 2014 and 2015, early 2015, was I knew that the formulations of nitrocellulose lacquers are still obtainable, but if you live in Los Angeles County or Orange County, the air quality management districts mandate the use of these very low volatile organic component, low VOCs, they're called, finishes. It's the only thing that's legal to be sold down here. I mean, it's the only thing that's legal to spray.
Yeah.
So I set aside a couple of months to learn to deal with these very low VOC, you know, smog-friendly nitrocellulose lacquer finishes, because it was all new chemistry. And then you also, it's the legal, you're legally compelled to spray them with a high-volume, low-pressure spray gun. Well, the HVLP guns didn't even exist back in 1972.
Sure.
So I knew it was going to be a new spray gun and chemically different nitrocellulose lacquers, and then it was going to be a starting from almost from scratch learning curve on how to get these things to work. So we'll table that part of the discussion for later in the call, but I didn't appreciate how nice and friendly, as toxic as they were and as bad for the environment as they were. They were fabulous finishes, really good finishes, really, you know, nice to apply and very tough, good film quality. So that's what I have always used for my steel stream.
So did you and David have a proper spray booth, or would you just kind of walk outside in Topanga Canyon there and spray?
In Topanga Canyon, we would walk out the back door, which just had a dirt backyard.
Yeah.
And spray right there overlooking Topanga Canyon Creek. And in fact, I continued that bad practice when I was building, when I had my second shop and my third as a solo. I would just go out into the parking lot and spray, which is, you know, today I would come down hard on anybody who was doing that in my parking lot. So, I was young and thought the world revolved around me. Now I have a spray booth.
Yeah. I'm guessing at this point in Topanga, you're into guitars, you know, 10 through 25 or something. Are they going all through Fred Walecki at this point?
Everything is going through Fred Walecki until probably 72. And in 72, probably late 72, I moved into my own shop. It might have even been early 73. And a few people were starting to find their way to me. I had enough of a reputation, all built on the basis of, you know, Fred being the, you know, the guy that was selling them, because it was a very high visibility location. But I also knew musicians from, you know, from playing around. And so a few people started to come to me. So there's a transitional time, 1972-3-4, when probably at the limit, maybe half or a little more than half of the sales were direct, where people would find me somehow through knowing somebody, or, you know, knowing somebody who knew somebody. And so I was doing direct sales, and I think that at the peak, guitars then might have been selling for about $1,200 in 73, 74. So it was a big difference between getting 60% of that versus getting all of it.
Yeah.
And that it helped a lot. It didn't, you know, it didn't put you over the hump to having a middle class existence.
Sure.
But it made having the shop a lot less precarious.
Why did you and David part ways with the shop?
The shop kind of got too small for both of us. You know, we got to the point where it was too cramped. It was also kind of a tough drive for me, because I was by then living back in the valley. And Topanga Canyon was a long and winding road.
Yeah.
So David stayed in Topanga. I don't know how long he stayed in Topanga. I kind of lost touch with when he moved down in there. I think he was there for a good long while. But I moved back to the San Fernando Valley, to Tarzana, which is at the south end of the San Fernando Valley.
Yeah.
Which actually also had vastly better guitar-making weather, because it was further from the coast. It was lower average relative humidity all the time. And when the Santa Ana winds blew through, which are the ones that clear all the moisture, they're the desert winds that clear all the moisture out of the valley. So they're they're the winds that you need in order to be bracing tops and backs and assembling boxes. And if you want to be assembling boxes at low humidity, which you do, I do anyway, you know, then you're at the mercy of the weather, and the weather was far better in the valley, and there were more days when you could spray without blushing problems. So it was a good move from that standpoint.
You know. Yeah.
And by that time, coming up with $150 a month was not quite so precarious. So
at what
I could do that.
Some of your guitars are, you know, associated with some pretty well-known players, James Taylor, Clarence White. Was there a moment where did you remember the first time a well-known player bought one of your guitars, either through Fred or from yourself?
Fred was selling most of them to people whose names I knew. Originally, Fred sold Clarence White his guitar, and I remember building that guitar. I built that guitar in the new shop. So, and that was in '73. I would have finished that in early '73, and Clarence was killed later. I forget if it was the summer of '72. So Clarence didn't have that for very long before he was killed in that tragic accident.
Yeah.
But Clarence was one of my, you know, he was my guitar hero, because he was the guy that I used to, when at the Ash Grove, that folk club,
yeah,
in Hollywood, you know, we used to go see the Kentucky Colonels, which was Clarence and his brother Roland, I want to say Billy Ray Latham on banjo,
yeah,
Roger Bush on bass. So really great players. But Clarence was, you know, Clarence was obviously a flat picking deity, and then we moved into the Byrds, and they did the Sweetheart Rodeo album. You know, that was a real groundbreaker. Dave and I played that album basically to death on the pitiful sound system in our shop.
Yeah,
just played until it was completely worn out. So Clarence was one of the first ones. Fred also sold a guitar. I'm trying to think of some of the people. Fred was selling to other named people. The way that I met James Taylor was really kind of roundabout. I had a friend in Topanga named John Hugg, and John Hugg acquired one of my guitars. And John was a studio musician, and his roommate was a guitar player for, it'll have to come to me, he was a big blues guy. But John Hugg showed his guitar to John McLaughlin, and McLaughlin subsequently ordered the guitar direct through his management company. So I had not met John at this time. This was just an order that came in from, you know, the management guys. And when McLaughlin came to pick up his guitar, so now I'm in my shop in Topanga Canyon, my shop in Tarzana in the San Fernando Valley. I finished the guitar, and John came to pick it up, and he brought James with him because McLaughlin was in town to play on what became the One Man Dog album, if I'm remembering correctly.
Okay.
That song had one of, that album had one of McLaughlin's songs on it. And he was playing on the album. So I met James, but I was only introduced to him as James, no last names. And all, you know, all I could think was, well, guys, he looks like James Taylor. And he's tall and he's slender, you know. And kind of soft-spoken. He's sort of what you would think of James Taylor's life. But I wasn't sure. So that whole day ended with me not sure if I had met James Taylor or not, but it turns out I had. So James is not, you know, the kind of person to say, hi, I'm James Taylor, I'm a really important musician. You love my work.
Sure.
Even though that was all true.
Was there a...
So I didn't... Yeah. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. You go ahead.
Well, James subsequently ordered... he ordered a couple of guitars directly, and then there were more guitars over time. So this was probably 72, 73, 74, 75. I was building guitars, you know, some dreadnoughts, some new stuff that he wanted that required me to build new molds. I would, you know, was building guitars for James.
Do you know how many you built for him?
I want to say 6 or 7. I built 3 dreads, I believe. The first two I know for sure. One was a Brazilian rosewood dread with a spruce top, and the other was an East Indian rosewood dread with a cedar top. And those were the first two, and those two are signified by having an inlay on the peg head that was cut out like a Mizpah coin. Do you know what a Mizpah coin is?
No.
It's a coin. I'm not sure what the root is. It's M-I-Z-P-A-H. I don't know what the language is. But it's a coin that is sawed in half in sort of a zigzag pattern so that the two halves fit together to make one coin. You use a real fine curved blade to do this. You keep one half, and the person that you are sharing the coin with keeps the other half. And then you're sort of bonded by this thing that you each have half of.
Got it.
The inlays were traced, and they weren't traced. They were drawn from a tattoo that James has on his shoulder. So I drew the tattoo, and the tattoo has 3 main parts, and I cut the shell for the inlay out with 2 pieces of shell overlaid one another so that the pieces from the top shell would fit with the bottom shell and vice versa.
Got it.
And then I mixed pieces up and used them on these 2 guitars. So the guitars are connected by this Mizpah coin thing where the abalone piece of guitar A fits in with the pearl piece of guitar B.
And then he...
Why I did this, I don't recall, but I did. Those first two guitars were his and Carly's, because he had just married Carly Simon at that point, or was about to marry Carly Simon.
And just to...
I think they were married by the guitars were done.
Just to be clear, your art ended up being a tattoo on his shoulder?
The other way around.
Oh, okay.
His tattoo on his shoulder ended up being what I copied to do the inlay on guitars, which must have mean he asked me to do that, or I wouldn't have known he had that.
Yeah. And so was there a point...
He had the tattoo.
Is there a point where you're standing over James Taylor with tracing paper on his shoulder?
I don't recall how I got that.
Okay.
You know, it's a good question, and I don't know. I still have paper copies of the pattern that I use for that.
I'd love to see that.
You know, sitting in my little stash of stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was a story associated with the tattoo, but, you know, the story is, anybody who has a tattoo, the story is always theirs to tell.
Yeah, of course.
So I would not tell his story, but, you know, people have seen his tattoo, and people have seen the shell because it's on the peg out of the guitar. So, they've seen me.
The first sort of big chapter of your career, it sounded like you were mainly building guitars on spec and sending them to Fred, and he would sell them to whomever would come through Westwood. Now you're kind of, it sounds like, starting to take custom orders. Artists have their own quirks. Did you enjoy that challenge, or, you know, just that James Taylor might have a very specific need and you have to fill it?
Well, James Taylor, of course, is unique because he's James Taylor.
Sure.
You know, in retrospect, we can all look back and say, God, here's a guy who's had a 50-year career, and he's still going, you know, more than strong. So he's such an exception in every possible way. You know, his playing, his songwriting, his singing, everything about him is amazing and unique. And it was just nothing but but pure luck and happenstance that someone whose music, you know, I so admired walked into my shop. You know, when Sweet Baby James came out, I thought I would never hear anything as good as that again in my life. Mm-hmm. Other guitar customers, you know, the experience is varied because people vary. It was Fred Wallachy's contention when we were selling everything through Fred that the best way for Dave and I to work would be to be guitar makers and have him deal with all the ins and outs of dealing at the retail level with customers. And I think you can make a pretty strong argument that Fred's perspective is sensible, because once I had the shop, you know, once I had my own shop in particular, where it was more people knew where it was and it was easier to get to. That was probably part of it. You didn't have to drive, you know, to Helangon out to Panga Canyon to get to it.
Sure.
I started having people show up all the time. So it was interfering. It was interfering with me being able to work. And I don't know that I ever learned to be a hard guy about it, but I started working with my roll-up door rolled all the way down and my walk-in door locked, you know, to kind of discourage that stuff if I really had to get work done. And you always have to get work done when you're building guitars. So the experience is varied.
Sure.
You know, some people were a real pleasure and other people were more difficult to deal with, you know. Orders got changed and the lesson I took away from that, and this is also jumping forward, was when I set up the shop again in late 2014, I decided I wasn't going to take orders. I wasn't going to take deposits. There wouldn't be a list. I wouldn't build anything out of combinations of wood that somebody thought was interesting. In fact, I wouldn't even do custom inlays. I was just going to build what I thought was interesting for me to build. And if at the end of that process there were people who were interested in buying the guitars, that would be good. And if it didn't work out that way, then I would just be out a whole lot of money and be sorry that I did it. You know, because these days shops aren't $150. You know, they're closer to $2,000 where I live.
Yeah, of course.
And so you have to sign a lease, and the lease is for a couple of years. So you know, I thought, well, I could easily be making a $50,000 mistake, which was about wrong by about a factor or two. A 2-year lease would be about a $1,000 mistake. But I didn't know exactly what the costs were going to be.
Yeah.
But in any case, the second time around, I just stayed away from that. Because if you don't have a list and you don't have orders, you don't have people calling up and saying, I got a really big gig coming up in, you know, July. The guitar has got to be finished by then. Because the moment you have that time pressure,
yeah,
now you're working to the clock. And if you're working to the clock, then you know, you have to be working backwards from the end date, and you have to do things by a certain time, whether the guitar and the weather are cooperating or not.
Sure.
And so you push things, and when you push things, you make compromises that you later wish you really had not made. So having learned that lesson, you know, never catastrophically, but I decided I just wasn't going to do that. So. But as it turns out, everybody who's bought a guitar from me from this recent incarnation,
yeah,
they've all been wonderful people. And I love these guys to death. You know, they're great musicians. They're really good players. They're really nice people. They're just, you know, sweet guys, good to be around. And, you know, we're just kind of social friends. And probably not by accident, almost every one of them either owned a Whitebook guitar in the past and sold it, or owns more than one, you know, and has something that I built in the 70s still. So they're not collectors, they're working musicians, but they're working musicians that have gotten more than one guitar. So.
Sure.
So I've been lucky so far.
Yeah. Did taking those custom orders, like you said, I think with James Taylor, did that finally allow you to start building some instruments that weren't dreadnoughts, and was that fun for you?
That was great fun for me. I actually have, for steel strings, I have four mold shapes. There's the dreadnoughts, the vast majority of which were rosewood, either East Indian or Brazilian, because of what I called the tyranny of the rosewood dreadnought, thinking we were all competing with Martin. But James, being an interesting guy, you know, he actually asked for some other shapes and sizes, the first one of which was had a quinto guitar, a three-quarter size guitar, right after his first child, his daughter, Sarah Maria, was born, so Sally Taylor. So she was, I don't think she was even a year old, and he asked if I could build a small guitar so that when she was big enough, you know, to learn, she'd have a guitar. And so I designed a quinto, a short scale, small body guitar. And I built that for James. And his daughter never saw that, because that became one of his players. That there was, I think it was the Flag album, had a pullout picture of James sitting at like this little white formica table with a little cassette recorder on the table, playing this little bitty guitar. And that's the guitar that I built for Sally Taylor, theoretically for Sally Taylor.
Yeah.
And so that was the first custom thing I did that involved starting by designing the guitar and then, you know, making a mold for it and then making a bending form and doing all this stuff. And then later on, James asked for a smaller bodied guitar, you know, something that was intermediate. And for that, I used my classic guitar shape, so which was traced from a Marcello Barbero Flamenco, because it's just great body shape, really pretty. And what I did on that to turn into a steel string, besides the obvious stuff, like brace it like a steel string, was I took the pattern and just about at the center of the upper bouts, where the upper bouts are the widest, where the side would normally continue to curve over to meet the neck at the 12th fret, I tightened up that radius, that curve, so that the upper bout meets the neck at the 14th fret, which makes the body shorter by the distance between the 12th and 14th. So that it would be a Barbero classical guitar profile body, except for this shortening the upper bouts to meet the neck at the 14th.
Got it.
And then that first one that I did was a slightly short scale neck. It wasn't my normal full scale. So I moved the bridge to compensate and then did what I described earlier, which is, you draw the body, put in the neck at the 14th, and now you know where the saddle is going to be, draw on the bridge, then start laying out the bracing underneath it. So that on that mold, I had originally built just one of those, and I wrote on the mold, so I'd know which one it was, JT Special. And so today, I have since built several more guitars from that mold. And I've also built more guitars from the Requinto mold, for the baby guitar mold, the Requinto. And I just refer to the intermediate size as a JTS.
Got it.
It's not my place to use James's name on it. without royalties, certainly.
Yeah.
But, with recognition where it came from.
Yeah.
And the Requinto. And in fact, as it turns out, now that I'm not strictly a bluegrass player anymore, that JTS, that's the guitar that fits me the best. It was those intermediate sizes.
Yeah.
And I tend to migrate toward them first when I sit down to play, and I sit down to play every day. So I see where he was coming from, you know, wanting something different size, both for the sound you get and for the way it sits and feels. Although, you know, I'm probably 8 inches shorter than James, if not more. You know, a totally different frame. So it works for me. I don't know how it worked for him.
Yeah. It sounds like Tarzana was really, you know, obviously where you were the most prolific, where you really established your name. What was the small luthery, small guitar making community like in Los Angeles in those early 70s? I know it was you and Dave Young, and Chuck was probably starting to move.
He was moving out of the banjo business and just becoming more and more a shell guy.
Yeah.
So he wasn't the Duke of Pearl yet. It was still Erica Banjos. But more of his time was taken up with the shell business, because the shell business was a real business.
Yeah.
You know, which is why of all of us, Chuck is now, you know, Chuck really prospered at that, as he should have, because he's, you know, really just a brilliant guy. It was myself. Roy Noble was real busy all the time. Dave Young was real busy. Ren Ferguson was in the community. So I knew Ren when, I think Ren was building his first guitar. I remember seeing Ren somewhere. I think Ren might have pulled up at Fred Gerlach's place.
Okay.
To buy wood. And Ren had just a neck in the back of his car.
Nice.
I remember this real, I remember it well enough to know it was just a neck. There wasn't a guitar attached. So it was like a neck blank. I don't think it was shaped yet. I don't think it had a fingerboard on it. It might have been a blank with a peg head done or something like that. So Randy was probably fairly early into his building career then. There was another guy whose name escapes me, and I don't think I'm going to remember it, but he ended up being the guy that built, it might have been a Telecaster pattern solid body electric for John McLaughlin.
Okay.
That had a real, it had a lot of carving on it. You can tell that I'm 68 years old. Names are coming more.
That's all right.
And Don Musser was just getting started. He was actually, it was pre when Don Musser got started, but I had met Don. So he was around. Bob Givens was still around, but he wasn't in the San Fernando Valley. Bob had been very instrumental in Chuck Erickson's education. So Chuck gives a lot of credit to Bob Givens, who was a banjo. As far as I know, Bob was making banjos and mandolins. John Carruthers was working for Fred as a repairman, and John Carruthers later became, he opened up his own shop, I think in Santa Monica. And I don't know that John was ever building, or at least not very much, but he was well known for his repair work. And he was also a columnist for, was it Guitar Player magazine?
I think so, yeah.
I think it was. It was, you know, a repair and maintenance column.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the local community of guys.
Were you sharing, showing off guitars, getting feedback, or were you just kind of all working in your own little vacuums and then seeing each other at Fred Gerlach's once in a while?
Well, by that time, I wasn't buying wood for Fred anymore because I had a bandsaw that was equipped for resawing.
Okay.
So I was doing all my own resawing once I was in Tarzana, which really helped a lot in terms of just control over the materials. And it meant I was buying boards, you know, big stuff that was 9 inches wide and 2 inches thick and, you know, 8 feet long and heavy and serious, where I was beginning to have, there's more opportunity and more risk.
Yeah.
You know, the opportunity is you're going to get some really nice sets of wood, and the risk is you're going to slice this board open and find that it's full of pitch pockets and knots and pinholes and checks and stuff that, you know, that render it mostly scrap. But that's actually a part that I really, really enjoy.
Yeah.
I like guitar making on both ends a lot. I like resawing wood. So you find out if you've made good or lucky guesses on whether this is going to make nice guitars.
Yeah.
And I like stringing guitars up, you know, and playing them for the first time. And in between, I try and get from the resawing to the playing.
Yeah.
I was really just kind of cocooned. I was still really poor. You know, when I say that having people come direct and so not giving up 40% and, you know, for the dealer discount and the guitar is going from $750, you know, up to $1,000 or even $1,200. Those were all really good steps, but that didn't make any of us really anything like prosperous. It was all still hand to mouth. So in mid-73, I married my first wife. And so by mid-74, you know, trying to be a married guy, that just put enough pressure on the financial end of guitar making that I just couldn't sustain it. Between what it was doing to my health and what it wasn't doing financially, I started working at another job. So I became a full-time working guy. From about 74 to 75, I worked full-time, then I quit, then I went back. And then by 75, I was doing something else to live on and building guitars nights and weekends. So from 74, 75 until 1980, the shop was much less productive, you know, probably averaged 2.5 guitars a year.
Wow.
Which means basically that I was supporting it out of my pocket from my work earnings to do that. But I wasn't ready to give it up. I didn't have any illusions that I could make a living from it. But when I first started working full-time, I still had commitments for guitars that had to be completed. So I had to do that. And then I found that, you know, I still enjoyed it. And then I was working full-time and then working the rest of the time in the shop. And then eventually, having blown my chance to go to college right out of high school,
yeah,
and realizing that I needed a degree if I was going to be a working guy, not building guitars. You know, I went back to school at night. So between building guitars part-time and working full-time and going to school at night.
And being married.
And of course, you know, what yielded all that eventually was being married. So, you know, my first marriage ended in divorce after 11 years, because I really couldn't do all that stuff.
Yeah.
It wasn't fair to my wife. But, you know, it's another thing that I know now that I didn't know then.
What was your, what job did you fall back on when you needed to?
You know, it wasn't something I actually fell back on. It wasn't a skill I already had. It was something brand new. The shop in Tarzana was in a little industrial complex, you know, a bunch of 600 to 1,000 square foot adjoining concrete floored hobbit holes.
Sure.
You know, all end, you know, side to side and end to end. And the guys that were across the parking lot from me were a bunch of used aircraft ex-employees, you know, guys, you know, real smart guys, engineers, that had started a company called Kinergetics, and they probably had 4 or 5 bays, and they eventually took over all of the building that was across from me. And so I knew the Kinergetics guys because worked a lot of the time, particularly in the summer, with my roll-up door open. So when your roll-up door is open, you know, you've got this 12-foot high by 10-foot wide hole in one wall of your shop where people are walking by. So they come in and they kibitz. So I knew all the Kinergetics guys. And one of them, kind of a mid-level manager, came over and offered me a job as a technician at Kinergetics, building cryogenic refrigerators, which are something about the size and weight of an old rotary dial phone.
Okay.
From back in the days when you leased them.
Okay.
And what they do is they provide several hundred milliwatts to maybe as much of a watt of refrigeration at very low temperatures, liquid nitrogen temperatures, 77 Kelvin. And so it's pretty sophisticated stuff. And what it's used for, what it was used for then and it is still now, is refrigerating infrared detectors for thermal vision, for night vision systems. So we were making a part of something, and the guys at this company had come out of Hughes Aircraft, the aerospace division, where they did all this kind of thermodynamic design and building stuff, basically R&D people, you know, real small. So they lived on contracts from the Air Force and from the Navy and that sort of thing. So I went to work for these guys as a technician, and I kind of parlayed working for Kinergetics, a bunch of ex-Hughes guys, to going to work at Ford Aerospace, also called Aeroneutronic Ford, which was in Newport Beach. And that was headed up by another guy who came from Hughes, from this thermal imaging business, named Peter Lockman. And Peter Lockman ran the thermal imaging division, the group, for Ford Aerospace in Newport Beach. So I went from building the refrigerators to building the electronics and imaging part of the system. And when I moved to the Newport Beach job, Pete Lockman, who knew I didn't have a degree, you know, everyone always said, well, you know, you really need a college degree, and then they would list all the reasons why you have to have it. And it was all sort of abstract. And Pete was a German immigrant, and he took a completely different tack. He said, no one's going to take you seriously unless you have this piece of paper. So just go get the piece of paper. Just do it.
Yeah.
And that was the whole speech. And that turned out to be the right speech. So because I respected Pete so much, I just liked this guy. He was really smart, you know, a little strange, really interesting guy. And he just put it in a way that made sense. So I went back to school. I started going back to school at night for an electrical engineering degree when I was working for Pete.
Got it.
So that's what I ended up with.
And did that, that ended up becoming like your full-time job when you gave up guitars too?
That was my full-time. I was still building guitars when I worked at Aeroneutronic Ford. And then Pete Lockman left Aeroneutronic Ford, and with his wife, Kathy Lockman, who was a PhD in electronics and laser physics, they started a laser company in their garage.
Okay.
And about a year later, I joined Pete and Kathy at the laser company when it was still a startup. So now I'm in a startup, working Monday, Tuesday, you know, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, lots of Sundays, going to school at night. And I knew when I joined a startup with Pete and Kathy, you know, I knew before I ever set foot in the door that I would have to close the guitar shop. There was just no way.
Yeah.
You know, startups, you can't be, you don't come in at 8 and go home at 5 in a startup. And you just don't. So I thought it was a great opportunity, which it was, and I thought it would be a lot of fun, which it also was, but I knew that I would have to close the shop. So in 1980, when I went to work for Pete and Kathy at their electro-optics company, designing lasers. Then I closed up the shop and I put everything in storage until late 2014.
You kept all your tools and everything?
I kept all the tools. You know, it's one of those things, 35 years of storage. You know, the market value of those tools was probably paid for 20 times over.
Yeah.
You know, the wood that I had, the wood I could keep in the shelf in my closet, that's not very big.
Yeah.
You know.
That's gone up in value. The Brazilian has gone up in value. Tools may not have, but...
The tools haven't. Now, the tools really haven't, but the tools were so personal. The way I describe it to people, I say, you know, guitar making to me was like one of those blood infections that you pick up when you're in Africa, you know, where eventually they can control the symptoms, but they can't cure the underlying disease.
Got it.
And it's always there waiting to flare up. And I just always had it in the back of my mind that someday I would try and do that again. And as weird as it sounds weird even to me, and I'm going to say it. You know, I had this wood, and it's nice guitar wood, you know. It's really beautiful stuff. And I have always really been in love with wood. I just think it's just, you know, I think wood and shell are the most magical materials around. And, you know, my job as a luthier is to do them justice, because nothing I ever do will look as good as a good piece of wood, you know. There's no technique I can apply to it that is going to somehow make it better than it can be.
Yeah.
And I felt like this stash of wood from the 70s, 60s and 70s, you know, of all the wood in the world, these were the boards that I found at the places where I used to go in Los Angeles and the San Fernando Valley to shop, because I didn't have, you know, I didn't have a very wide radius of action as a wood shopper. There's this tiny corner of the world where these rare woods are showing up. Here's the part that, you know, I think can be made into guitars and that I have money for before somebody else snaps it up. So I had always felt like this wood had sort of been entrusted to me, you know, that I had a duty to it to either build guitars out of it or find some good guitar maker when I was sure that I wasn't going to make guitars out of it, you know, and give it to him.
Yeah.
Because it'd be criminal for it to end up, you know, on the lawn in an estate sale.
Yeah.
And somebody, you know, uses it to do decoupage on for their kids. So the wood was always there reminding me, and the tools were always in storage. And when the tools finally did come out of storage, you know, it was a terrible economic decision to store them for all those years. But when they came out and were rehabilitated, which was a couple of months of work, you know, they were my tools.
Yeah.
You know, they've got my imprint on them, and I've got theirs. So I don't know that I would have been comfortable or maybe able to start over by buying a bunch of new tools and having to learn to set them up from scratch and, you know, work with them and feel comfortable with them.
When you decided in 2014 to come back and build guitars again, were you trying to replicate your old shop setup in terms of where the tools were and where all the equipment went?
No, not at all. Shop space is really, really hard to find around here. It's not the kind of space. These small industrial units with concrete floors, they're not the kind of space that is particularly fashionable in South Orange County. So there isn't much of it. And where it is tends to be pretty gritty and dangerous, a lot of it. So I was lucky to find anything at all. It was just a matter of timing. It was horrendously expensive, but I knew, you know, that was going to be the price going in. And so once I spent a couple of months just getting the tools all fixed back up and operable, you know, really good as new, as they say, or better than new, because now they have a story. And then I laid out the tools according to sort of the dictates of the shop space. You know, I always start by laying it out the way that it seems to make sense. And then after about 6 months in the shop, you realize what was right and what was wrong about it, and you reorganize the tools, you know, a little or a lot.
Yeah.
And then it kind of sticks from there. It was really, for me, a question of getting enough space without getting too much space. You know, I couldn't afford a 2,000 square foot space, sure. But it's nice to have. And I couldn't do it in less than 1,200 square feet. It would be too cramped for me these days.
Yeah.
Especially since I knew I wanted to, you know, build a spray booth, you know, do it upright. So it was a question of finding enough space and putting the tools where they belonged. And probably the only difference from the old days is the industrial spaces, the small industrial spaces around here, tend to have little dedicated office spaces in front. So they've got a front entrance, like a centralized place, and then a rear entrance, which is the roll-up door, and then the second walk-in door. And the front entrances usually have small drywalled offices with drop ceilings and fluorescent lights.
Yep.
None of which I use for work. Now, to me, that's square footage lost, but it turns out to be a real benefit to have that stuff for wood storage and for tool storage, and, you know, to have all the stuff that's out of the dust making area.
Sure.
Where you can close off a door and keep it relatively clean, so you have a place to retreat to, you know, for modestly clean air, and keep all the clutter out of the work area.
Yeah.
So that's probably the biggest change, is I've learned if I'm going to be making sawdust, and resawing makes a lot of dust, you want the shop area to be, have as little stored crap in it as possible, make it as easy to clean as possible, because the cleaner it is, the better I'm going to feel.
Yeah.
So.
And since you made 70 guitars back in the day, since 2014, 2015, when you started up again, how many have you made since?
I have completed 15.
It's pretty good.
And I have two more that look like nearly done guitars, one of which is fully lacquered and is in its 2-week drying phase. So I'll start sanding that out and rubbing it out on next Wednesday.
Wow.
And the second of which, of those two guitars, it's about midway through the lacquering process. This morning before our call, I went in and sanded it all out all over and sprayed one coat of lacquer, and then came home and cleaned up for our call.
Thank you.
And then I've got more going, but when this lease runs out, I'm at the beginning of my 8th month on the 2-year lease, and I don't expect to try to either extend the lease or renegotiate it or find another shop. I think my health will be at or beyond the breaking point by the time the 2 years is up. So
your health.
Now I'm just trying to play the balance game.
Yeah. Yeah. So I know, you know, you've said you were had asthma for your whole life, and I'm guessing ventilation and all that stuff has improved since your initial shop, but it's still affecting you in a bad way.
You know what has improved dramatically, actually, is when Dave and I had the shop together and my subsequent shops, we didn't own a drum sander, because drum sanders were capital investments. You know, that was tens of thousands of dollars, because you needed that plus a cyclone vacuum system. So we would have to lease time on a guy that had a job shop. And I didn't particularly care for doing that, because you don't have good control over how much of a cut a piece of wood gets taken on a piece of wood. And I've had wood ruined by being made too thin. So, you know, it's a level of control that I didn't care for. With the new shop, the only new tools that I bought were two very important tools. One was a drum sander wide enough to sand out the back and the top of a dreadnought guitar. Because those have gone from being industrial quality tools, tens of thousands of $1970 to acquire, to being serious hobbyist tools made in, I believe these are Taiwanese, they're Jet brand, and I think Jet's Taiwanese. They've been around a long time, but they're made to really very good standards. I was tremendously impressed with how good the Taiwanese stuff has become. So I got a drum sander because I had wood that still needed to be resawed, joined, and thinned, and I just wasn't going to do it any other way but, you know, full control over that process. And the corollary is, if you have the drum sander, the non-negotiable accessory is you need a big vacuum dust collector.
Sure.
And those likewise have gone from being, you know, thousands to tens of thousands of dollars of professionally installed, you know, three-phase motor, 5-horsepower cyclone vacuum systems, to being at the very serious shop amateur level. You can now buy 1.5-horse, 2-horsepower dust collector, you know, with a 1 or 2 micron HEPA filter output and a, you know, a collection bag.
Yeah.
And these things are like magic. So now a lot of the stuff that I used to do, the resawing, since I've equipped my band saws with dust collection ports, now the amount of dust that becomes airborne is a tiny fraction of what it used to be. But as I did in the 70s, I spend all of every day in the shop either behind a disposable high quality paper dust mask,
yeah,
you know, for real low concentrations, or else a silicone rubber half face mask that covers your nose to your chin and has, you know, two big cylindrical cartridges on it with organic vapor filters and particulate filters. So I live behind that stuff, and I always live behind that stuff, and that, you know, that helps a lot. But it doesn't stop 100%. If I were a normal, healthy guy, I'd probably feel great all the time. But even with these precautions, just because of my sensitivity to the particulates,
yeah.
You know, the lacquer fume, people always go, it must be the lacquer and the glue. Well, the glue's water-based. It's as benign as it gets. And I really don't get exposed to the lacquer fumes because I've got a really good spray booth.
Yeah.
You know, so my exposure to that stuff is really negligible, but it's still all just the fine particulates. And, you know, when you get to micron-sized stuff, it gets airborne and it stays airborne. It just never goes away in the shop. So you're always exposed, and it's always causing me problems. And I deal with the consequences. What's different besides better dust collection, affordable dust collection from the 70s, is that pharmaceuticals for people like me have gotten a lot more sophisticated, and they can kind of damp that allergic response down with drugs, but I hate being drugged up all the time this way. So
yeah.
But, you know, it's worth it to have guitars, right?
I guess so.
I mean, it must be.
Yeah, you're doing it.
I take that, you know, I weigh that balance every day and still go into the shop. So.
Well, how?
Anyhow.
How do your guitars of this current batch, the last couple of years, in your mind, how do they compare to the ones that everybody still talks about on the internet forums and raves about?
I wouldn't make the judgment for anybody else, but for me as a player, I like these guitars better. And so that's a, you know, that's a judgment. The one thing I would say that I think I can kind of divorce myself, no one's impartial about their instruments. What I am enjoying is that I think the consistency of the instruments is much better now, or at least it's better on better on the whole. And part of the reason is I don't take orders. There's no list. I don't have anybody's money. I don't, you know, I don't take phone calls. I don't spend my time doing that stuff. So every guitar takes as long as it takes to build. I mean, 14 guitars in 2.5 years is certainly about half of what a one-man shop is capable of doing if you are 22 years old and you're willing to work 12-hour days,
sure,
7 days a week. But I'm 68 and a half. And not only am I not willing to do that, but I wouldn't be able to do it and maintain just balance with my health. And it wouldn't be fun for me. And, you know, and so my specific output is low. And that's the bad part. But the good part is I'm really enjoying it. And the guitars, no guitar is ever pressed. No operation is ever, you know, I don't know, shit, you know, maybe I can push this by a day because I don't have to. It doesn't matter. The way I'm looking at these guitars now is I have a 1971 White Book Dreadnought, which was Phil Keaggy's old guitar. So it's 46 years old. And so I started in late 2014 with a perspective that every guitar that I build now is going to outlive me for absolute sure.
Sure.
You know, barring fire or flood or horrible accident. So I'm building these guitars with the idea that everything I'm building now is going to be around here in 50, you know, it's going to be around in 50 years, and it's going to be played by the sons and daughters or friends or cousins or customers of the people that are buying them now. So I'm working more with a 50-year perspective, and that means, you know, just go slow and enjoy the process.
Yeah. Have you?
And so there.
Go ahead.
I feel like I have more control because I'm not, I don't ever have to do anything that I'm not ready to do because of the financial considerations. Meaning, if I don't finish a guitar, I can't pay my rent.
Yeah. I hope you raised your prices.
The prices have been $15,000.
Okay.
I talked to a good friend of mine, Paul Smanda, who's a collector, and he has one of my guitars from the '70s and one of the new ones. And I talked to Paul when I started doing this, and I said, Paul, you know, I really need help. I know that as a collector, you understand the collector guitar market. I know that the guitars that I made in the '70s are changing hands in the range from $20,000 to $30,000. You know, and I don't know how to price the new ones so that I don't screw up the collector market. You know, I don't want to be making trouble for guys like you who put, you know, your capital into collectibles.
Yeah.
By the same token, if I don't get a certain amount of money for them, then I want, you know, the shop will end up having to be funded out of my very meager retirement savings, and I can't do that. And so Paul counseled me on it. He said, well, start at 15. That's what the good guys get. Says, and tell people that you're going to be raising them up, you know, toward 20 as time goes on.
Yeah.
And so that's where I am now.
So I have to ask, you gave this impassioned plea about, you know, why it was so important to, and emotional to keep your tools in storage while you still had your day job. If you hang up in a year or two when your lease expires, are you going to hold on to those tools still?
No, I don't think I will.
Wow.
And the reason is It's the other lesson that I now know very well. It's just tattooed on my soul. Storage is expensive.
Yeah.
You pay as much a square foot for storage. It costs me as much per square foot to store stuff as it costs me to have a working shop space.
Yeah.
You know, storage is a good business to be in if you're the guy building the storage unit. So I would not be able to make those payments on 500 square feet of storage space.
Yeah.
To put all this stuff, that, you know, that's $6,000 a year that goes out, and I'm retired.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have income, so I can't do that. I'm not sure what I'm going to do. I have a young friend who has an obvious interest in this stuff, who lived locally here in L.A. And he was interested. We talked briefly about maybe him taking this over when I was ready to close up.
Mm-hmm.
But he has since moved back to Nashville, which makes it, you know, a harder thing to do, because it was going to be, my idea was, he buys the tools, you know, we build a guitar together. I show him what I know, you know, what I think I know, what I do, and my justification for doing it that way. And then he takes it from there, and then he gets a jointly built guitar plus tool.
Yeah.
So since he has moved, I don't know what's going to happen, and I've got a fairly short horizon to try and figure something out.
Well, there's probably no shortage of people who would jump on the chance to do what you just suggested for that one guy. So if you wanted to put the word out, I'm sure folks would line up.
That might be a thing to do. And there's also one other element to this, which is, you know, there were no literary schools in the United States when I was a young guy. But now I know there's Roberto Van. I've heard really good things.
Sure.
About Roberto Van. And I know that there are other good literary schools. So it's not that anybody needs me, you know, to show them how I built guitars. It's just that if I could pass it on, you know, as a starting point for somebody else. You know these are the, because some of the stuff is so simple and obvious that you think that you are born knowing it, and it took me 40 years to learn it, you know, and none of it's a trick. There's no magic bullet, you know, but it's just decent advice. And even if somebody ignored it a little bit, they'd remember it later on when they found out that they were having trouble with something and said, oh, okay, I see. That's why he said, try it doing it this way.
Yeah.
None of us likes to think that when we're dead, everything we know goes with us, but everything we know goes with us, you know.
It's true.
So.
Well, Mark, thank you for talking.
Well, I'm that morbid.
Yeah.